Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Kevin Featherstone and I'm the head of the European Institute here at the London School of Economics. I'm delighted to welcome you to tonight's public lecture. This is part of a series which is produced by our research unit, LISI Research Unit on Southeast Europe here at the school. And I'm very proud to be welcoming our speaker, the President of Croatia, Kolinda Grabar-Kitarović. She has been President since January 2015. Before that, she has a very impressive CV, been Minister of Foreign Affairs and European Integration. She was head of the negotiations for Croatia's accession to the European Union. She served as ambassador in Washington and for a period also with NATO, where she was the highest-ranking woman in NATO's history. The president was educated in New Mexico. She holds degrees from the University of Zagreb and the Diplomatic Academy in Vienna. She's also been a Fulbright Scholar at George Washington University and a fellow at the JFK School of Government at Harvard. With that CV, she had to come to the London School of Economics. So fortunately, the CV now looks really rather good. The title of her presentation tonight is A Defining Moment in European and Transatlantic Resilience, Croatian Perspectives. We are on a tight time schedule, but we will leave time for questions and answers afterwards. And I think normally there is a hashtag for you to follow on the screen, but I'm sure you can tweet as you wish as the lecture goes on. But because we're short of time, forgive me for the short introduction, but it is said with much warmth and appreciation. Can you join me in welcoming the President of Croatia?
Thank you, Professor Featherstone, distinguished members of the LSE faculty, dear students, excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. Winston Churchill once said, "A politician needs the ability to foretell what is going to happen tomorrow, next week, next month, and next year, and to also have the ability afterwards to explain why it didn't happen." Today, more than ever, when our world is changing rapidly, almost daily, we need leadership equipped not only with courage and competence, but also with foresight. I am delighted to be here with you tonight. It is indeed an addition to my CV, and to share some of my thoughts and concerns about Europe's future. I am told that the motto of your school is Rerum cognoscere causas, to know the causes of things. I strongly believe that this is crucial in our endeavors to respond efficiently to the challenges that we face today. We have to ask ourselves, what kind of world do we want to live in? What kind of Europe? Will Europe 10 or 15 years from now still be a prosperous and safe place, where our common European future is forged on the anvil of mutual respect and shared interests? I want to be part of a strong and inclusive Europe, a Europe that knows how to solve its problems and is adamant about resolving them and providing its irreplaceable contribution to the wider transatlantic community and beyond. I think that many of us feel that the defining moment is now, that our resilience is being tested. We're being tested as nations, as organizations, as leaders, and even as individuals. There is no question Europeans are resilient and experienced in dealing with challenges. But the magnitude of this latest challenge supersedes many difficult situations that we had faced so far. However, from my point of view, in order to halt the here and converging negative global trends affecting our transatlantic community, it is absolutely necessary that we work together to firstly reaffirm our commitments to our values and our principles. Secondly, to confront and address our challenges with an open mind towards the necessary changes. And lastly, maintain and advance strong foundations for long-term prosperity and development. These three objectives will affect our resilience, and that is what I would like to discuss with you today. The medical definition for resilience stipulates that resilience is a process of adapting well in the face of adversity, trauma, tragedy, threats of significant sources of stress. Europe as a whole has undergone a multitude of crises, ranging from wars and epidemics to economic crises. In projecting the course for the future, it is important to take a good look at the past, keeping in perspective where we as Europe were 70 years ago. One must not forget, even so many decades later, that the EU project began primarily as a framework designed to prevent another devastating war on the European soil. In this particular role, the European Union graduated magna cum laude. But what about the territory outside of the EU? What about my part of the world, Southeast Europe, or the Western Balkans, as some call it? The wars that the EU was not able to prevent or manage well, and that took years to resolve. When presented with numerous difficult political choices, our actions should arise out of a strong conviction that the values and principles on which our societies, alliances, and the entire international community are founded still serve us as beacons. Respect for individual liberties and human rights, democracy, the rule of law, respect for international law, adherence to peaceful resolution of conflicts, openness to cooperation, and genuine solidarity. If we uphold individual liberties and human rights, we will not tolerate the existence of a barbaric movement such as Daesh, which has demonstrated nothing but complete disregard for those values. If we uphold democracy, we will not tolerate attempts to constrain the sovereign rights of democratically elected governments to shape their country's futures. If we pride ourselves in supporting the rule of law, we will never concede to blatant breaches of international law like the forceful changing of borders and illegal annexation of other countries' territories. If we strongly rely on diplomacy and dialogue, no one should mistake our adherence to the peaceful solution of conflicts as a sign of weakness. We will not ask what the price of such adherence to principles might be, because there is no alternative to that. These are the cornerstones of our societies. If we allow them to erode or collapse, so will our societies and everything that we believe in. We must have the courage to confront our challenges, wisdom to understand them, and the patience to solve them. My second objective is about our task to enable our citizens to continue to live their lives and carry on with their daily routines without distress or apprehension, with a peace of mind, with confidence, and with optimism in our futures. Someone will say that being an optimist is out of fashion. I will not accept that. It was the optimism, a firm belief in success, that carried Croatia successfully through the hard years and put us firmly on the world map as an EU and NATO member state. There is too much pessimism and doomsday talk in today's politics. We should not paint an unrealistic picture when talking to our citizens, but at the same time, we must provide people with positive energy and perspectives. We must be aware of our strong suits and of our weak spots. Our main effort should be focused on using our abilities in the most effective and productive ways. The NATO-EU joint declaration signed on the margins of the last NATO summit in Warsaw is a prime example of complementary efforts, one which will enhance joint effectiveness without duplicating effort. I would agree with many who argue that these days the main choice we face about the future of the world order and of our own countries is to decide whether we opt for an open or a closed society. I firmly believe that in the current completely interconnected world, attempts at closing off one's country and its citizens from the onslaught and at times threatening changes are exercises in futility. Erecting walls cannot protect you fully from all threats in these digital times. Embracing and managing change is the right approach, in my opinion. I will admit that the outcome of the UK June referendum was a great shock to all of us, but also a wake-up call to the fact that there is an erosion of support between our citizens for the EU. It is born out of lack of understanding of what the EU represents. It underlies how essential it is that we bring the EU closer to our citizens. Croatia regrets the results of the referendum, but fully respects the UK citizens' decision. We understand the complex consequences of this decision for the UK, but for the EU and its other or remaining 27 member states as well. This island will not sail away across the ocean and throw anchor at some distant shore. It will stay where it has always been, with Europe and in Europe. It is with utmost confidence what I say that the UK will remain our trusted ally and a strong pillar in the transatlantic community. Croatia will continue to strengthen our alliance and friendship with the UK, and we're already exploring new avenues for our future relationship. People-to-people and business-to-business contacts should not be affected. Our dialogue on global challenges we share, from security, migration, sustainable development, to climate action, or on more immediate objectives of Southeast Europe and Mediterranean stability and prosperity, will continue. As Prime Minister May recently announced, by the end of March 2017, the UK will commence the exit negotiations process. Only the formal activation of Article 50 can mean the official beginning of perhaps a two-year-long negotiation. And it has been made clear that Brexit means Brexit. We all took a careful note of that. It is crucial that Brexit works well for everyone. For the one who is departing, and for the remaining 27 who are staying. Whether Brexit is in the end a harder or a softer one is still difficult to predict. The final outcome will definitely be a result of long and difficult negotiations, which, to borrow another phrase from the timeless vocabulary of Winston Churchill, we should leave no wire unpulled, no stone unturned, no cutlet uncooked. Croatia believes that the future EU-UK relationship should be the result of thorough negotiations conducted in good faith and with the prescribed legal and procedural codes. It is not only about trading arrangements and the access to the EU single market, framed by four fundamental freedoms: free movement of people, goods, capital, and services. It is also about preserving our joint and unique accomplishments, our decades of strategic partnership, and our commitment to the same shared values. This relationship needs to be tailor-made. Institutionally, the UK is part of the EU and of its policies in whose formulation it participated together with other member states and institutions. This very fact emphasizes the complexity and intertwinement of mutual connections and makes it clear that the Brexit negotiations should be unique in more ways than one. Both for the UK and the EU27, it will be a process like no other, with far-reaching consequences whose final scope no one can predict with absolute certainty. On the eve of the 60th anniversary of the signature of the Treaties of Rome in March 2017, the UK referendum provides an additional impulse for a comprehensive consideration of the future of the European Union. This new reality entails certain adjustments to the European Union project actions taken so far. It brings along new challenges and requires redefining some of our common interests so that the EU may provide protection and safety to its citizens to a better extent and respond to their concrete expectations more efficiently. We need a common vision of our common future as a motive and a driving force for further actions. Such considerations are to be led by our principles, achievements, and historical heritage, and by the European values the European project originated from and developed on, which are contained in the treaties and are the basis for our authenticity. Having focused on internal functioning, One should not overlook the fact that the EU has responsibility also for the area far beyond the European continent, in particular as regards promoting peace and stability in its immediate and broader neighborhood, as well as globally. Croatia believes in the future and strength of the EU project that has transformed a continent where the two most devastating wars in mankind's history had been born into one of the most peaceful parts of our planet. Guided by the principles of subsidiarity and proportionality, the EU must be able to provide answers to the concerns and expectations of its citizens and to problems that they face every day. It is not just about peace and security, it is also about feeling safe in a world that is facing global challenges plagued by terrorism, uncontrolled migrations, and conflicts spilling across the national borders. What our European citizens expect from the EU is to provide prosperity to them, economic security, financial stability, more well-paid jobs, and strong social security networks. And it needs to provide a promising perspective to the young to give them opportunities to live a better life than their parents had. Last but certainly not least, the EU needs to better communicate with its citizens and its strategic partners. The distance from Brussels and insufficient and often inadequate communication of the EU has to be considered as a serious liability. What we need urgently is a systematic and substantial argumentation about what the EU does for its citizens, why, how, and to what effect. The unity of the member states is the source of our strength and our most important asset. It needs to be preserved while fully respecting mutual differences. It is necessary to foster further the art of reaching agreements and compromising in the name of common interests. Certainly, we can discuss how to make some of the established mechanisms of cooperation between the states, whether global like the UN or regional like the EU and NATO, rise to the numerous challenges of the present in a better way. We have to preserve our unwavering transatlantic solidarity. Our mutual commitment to each other's security is the very basis of Europe's security architecture and has no alternative. When we discuss challenges facing Europe today, we must mention the diverse multitude of challenges emanating from an arc of instability that stretches to our east and the south of Europe. Russia's aggressive posture and acts in Ukraine undermine European stability. Against this background, complete implementation of the Minsk agreements remains an imperative. For the EU and each of its member states, the relationship with Russia stands very high on the list of priorities. The sooner that Russia modifies its behavior with the international law and eases pressure on its European neighbors, the more prosperous this relationship will be. Let me be clear, neither the EU nor NATO are enemies of Russia. As a matter of fact, in parallel to building our resilience, we also need a dialogue with Russia on many issues ranging from terrorism to resolving the root causes of many problems of today, such as migration. Terrorism, with Daesh at its forefront, threatens the existence of entire countries and has metastasized deeply into our own continent. We can successfully confront the serious challenge only through solidarity, better information sharing, better intelligence cooperation between the members of EU and NATO, and with sincere partnership among all those who are in the terrorist crosshairs. This means stepping up our efforts in countering radicalization and violent extremism. Looking further to the south, we need to show our solidarity with our partners in the MENA region. When we discuss migration, we have to work with the countries of origin and transit in order to reduce the push factors and ensure better cooperation in regards to return and readmission. The numbers in this field are as telling as they are worrying. The recent UN Secretary General's report states that in 2015, the number of international migrants and refugees reached 244 million, an increase of 71 million or 41% from the year 2000. The number of migrants is growing at a rate faster than the world's population. The majority of international migrants, 150 million, are migrant workers, accounting for 72.7% of the migrant population of working age. Around half of the world's international migrants are women, and one-third are young persons between 15 and 35 years of age. On the other hand, there are roughly 65 million forcibly displaced persons, including over 21 million refugees, 3 million asylum seekers, and over 40 million internally displaced persons. Yes, these are the statistics available today. But these are people, not just numbers. We have let this problem go on far too long. We must find the determination to resolve this issue. Implementing the UN 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development will address many of the root causes of migrations, and this is crucial for long-term progress. We should also be motivated by the recent commitment to the New York Declaration for Refugees and Migrants. Our immediate focus should be twofold: countering organized crime networks and human trafficking and people smuggling, while assisting countries in managing migration. Since last autumn, the EU has been practically supporting huge illegal industries of traffickers. Croatia spent around 20 million euros for assistance to migrants that only passed through its territory. Imagine how this money could have been spent in Syria, Somalia, or Afghanistan to address the root causes of conflict and migration. As to the so-called Western Balkans land migration route, it has been closed. The figures have been down, but we continue to monitor the situation. We have to remain vigilant as to a possible reactivation of this route. A prudent strategy is necessary to avoid the creation of ghettoized migrant communities all over Europe. Such a mistake has been made in the past, creating almost parallel societies. A heavy price has been paid. We need a strategy that should be created at the national level, but followed by an exchange of best practices at the international level in order to establish guidelines or recommendations and synergy of our efforts. The migration crisis has made it clear that a number of countries outside of the European Union or our NATO alliance are faced with the same challenges that we are, and we cannot abandon these countries. We must acknowledge that by doing so, Europe remains vulnerable. Openness for the enlargement has always been an important part of the EU strategic aegis. Keeping the door open for those who share the same values as we do, who strive toward the same goals, and with whom EU shares borders, should remain a trademark of our policy. The message that currently there is no appetite for NATO or EU enlargement is simply not permissible. Croatia will continue to support the EU and Euro-Atlantic aspirations of the countries in Southeast Europe by sharing our expertise, lessons learned, and know-how, and we will remain committed to keeping this issue high on the EU and NATO agenda. If we are successful in respecting our century-long values and implementing them through our policies and practices, we can anticipate long-term prosperity and development, which is my third and last point I want to make today. Although we are on the island described as green and pleasant land by poet William Blake, when it comes to economy and trade, no country can be an island. We're required by our economies and by the well-being of our citizens to open ourselves up for mutual cooperation and advancement. Opting for closed societies would have a detrimental effect for all aspects of what we know as Europe. The 60-year-old legacy of economic growth, social cohesion, and security collaboration is bound to decline if we stumble and sway in our work. We have to better understand each other's sensitivities and invest an effort in closing the divides between East and West, North and South, thus making Europe more resilient as a whole. Here, I would just like to mention our Three Seas Initiative connecting the Adriatic, Baltic, and Black Seas, an informal platform to strengthen the overall political, economic infrastructure, and security cooperation in Central Europe to the benefit of the entire EU and wider transatlantic community. The goal of this initiative is to establish a framework for securing political support and decisive action on specific cross-border strategic projects of interest to the states involved, without creating a parallel structure to the existing European and transatlantic associations and mechanisms of cooperation. Data shows that this area of Central Europe was the strongest one after the Chinese market before the crisis that hit Europe and the world, and the most resilient after the crisis. This strongly suggests that we're not only one of the global growth generations, but also the ones which will push the EU forward in the coming years. With our joint approach towards infrastructure, energy, and business development, we'll take a more proactive role in reaching the EU cohesion policy goals. By unlocking our synergy potential, we will be able to strongly improve the development of our joint competitiveness and added value chains amongst included countries. Thus, finally, bringing our countries to the level of economic development of the most developed EU countries. Not only will this improve our economic well-being, but it will strongly improve the competitiveness of the whole of the European Union on the global level. With a strong US economy, still rising Asian markets and economies, and international treaties looking towards strengthening the already strong economic ties between the biggest competitors, we have to look towards a future together as one economic entity as much as we can. Croatia has been hit with strong emigration flows since early 1990s. This brought with it the slower GDP growth and development. Our young and educated went to more developed countries and are still leaving, making them stronger and us weaker. To put it bluntly, in this situation, which we did not wish for, we can start thinking about changing the tide in our favor. Maybe some of you here will be coming to Croatia with your businesses or with your companies and not the other way around. Maybe this is a moment in which we can persuade you to enjoy Croatia for a longer period than just a summer vacation. Ladies and gentlemen, taking the right path always requires making a difficult and demanding choice. We have to develop and show the resolve and courage to make these choices and to explain to our citizens why they are not just right, but necessary if we want to safeguard our future. We can achieve this if we practice what we preach and do more than just meet and debate. In essence, we need bold leadership. Leadership and learning are indispensable to each other, said John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who is about to be a student here at the LSE, but unfortunately was prevented by his ill health. I strongly believe in lifelong learning, and I urge all of you to embrace the challenges that lie ahead of us all. We all have to embrace these challenges. I'm counting on you to assume your role in making the world and our European continent more resilient. I thank you for your attention, and I'm very much looking forward to our discussion.
Thank you, President, for a very interesting speech and a very wide-ranging speech. So I'm sure there's going to be lots of questions. We have colleagues with microphones. I'm going to invite you to ask a question. Please, could you just simply tell us who you are and then ask a question? I'm afraid there's no time for speeches, so for questions, and we'll try to accommodate as many people as possible. Could we take the lady here, please?
Hi, my name is Adila Saliman. I'm from Reuters. I just wanted to ask you, you approved the Prime Minister designate yesterday, what you thought the main priorities were now for your new government.
Okay, thank you. Let's take a couple of speeches. Gentlemen here, please.
Hello, my name is Jakov. I'm extremely happy to see you here. Can I just say this first?
Thank you. Likewise.
You said in your talk that the reason why European citizens do not, perhaps are not happy about the European Union is because they don't understand it very well. Can you maybe clarify what things should be understood by the general population that are not? Thank you.
Thank you. The final question, gentleman at the front. Oh, sorry.
Bernard Casey from LSE. You mentioned NATO almost as much as you mentioned the EU. Can you tell me whether there are NATO values as opposed to EU values, and which are the more important?
Okay, thank you. Shall we take those questions
yes,
first?
Yes, of course.
I'm afraid they're on many different themes, but...
thank you very much. I appointed the Prime Minister designate yesterday, and I hope that he will be successful in securing an approval by the Parliament for his new government. And I believe that finally Croatia will redirect the focus of the political debate within the country from the past to the future, and that we will overcome the divisions that plague our society. Unfortunately, the whole of the European Union has experienced closing in of societies, and this is why I said that I think that the basic choice today is between an open and a closed society. And we want for Croatia to be an open society, to focus on the future and on the existential issues that matter to people, including demographics. I mentioned so many young people who are leaving Croatia. We educate them, we invest in them, and then they invest into some other country's economy or demographics, prosperity, etc. Of course, everybody has to have the freedom to travel, to work, to study abroad, but we hope that they will come back to Croatia. And this is what we have to start doing, creating those circumstances, which includes not just economic development, social circumstances and housing, but also a climate of optimism, of belief in our future, and of a positive overall climate in society where people are not plagued by these differences, us or them. So this is my wish for the new government, of course, to be successful in improving our economic position, but also in keeping the young and attracting the young back to Croatia. The EU citizens, why we need to get closer to the EU citizens and explain the values of the European project, which began as a peace process and is based on values. And I take values as actually one of the most important aspects of both the European Union and NATO. You will see that if you look at Eurobarometer polling, that the countries who joined relatively recently the European Union, the support of the population is still higher than in some older, although of course I don't like to put countries into categories of old and new member states, but those countries who have enjoyed freedom, democracy, open borders for a much longer time than we did. And one of the highest support levels are actually in Croatia, which in the 90s had war, aggression, and we had to rebuild Croatia. We have had to work on reconciliation. So we still remember the values of peace and security. And this is what we need to tell people. You cannot take peace and security for granted. Somebody's working every single day to preserve it. And now it comes down to the citizens, not only with respect to the threats, because terrorism requires vigilance from all of us, from every single citizen, but also vigilance of the values such as solidarity. We've seen that the migration crisis has become an existential threat to the European Union, not because it will disappear from the map, but because it has become a centrifugal force that's pulling countries further apart. We're shifting the blame onto each other. We're not really resolving the problem. We're focusing on the 1.2 million people who are on the European soil, and we're not concentrating on how to deal with the root causes of migrations, which will be a long-term challenge for the European Union. So to remind people what a Europe of borders, of walls, of divisions, a Europe where you did not have a choice as an individual citizen, where you could not leave your own country without a permission from the government, what it looked like. So today, especially the young people take everything for granted, but we have come a long way in order to be able to provide for those rights that are the basis of our systems. And sir, NATO and EU values, you know, I used to be NATO Assistant Secretary General for Public Diplomacy, and that may be one of the reasons why I mentioned NATO so much. I'm also Commander-in-Chief of our armed forces. But what if Brexit does happen, and I suppose it will, it really is up to the UK, but what will still connect us will be NATO, will be the Transatlantic Alliance and the security. And the same values are enshrined in the Washington Treaty and in the treaties, the different treaties of the European Union and the European communities. The same values of democracy, of liberty, of individual rights, of freedom of choice. So when I used to talk about NATO per se in my former capacity, I would always say, yes, it is a military alliance, but it is also a political alliance, an alliance of values. And I think that still the one of the basic values is solidarity, and Article 5 as the backbone of the alliance, that an attack on one is an attack on all, which provides for the resilience of the alliance and of the whole continent. And this is what we have to demonstrate, not just in eastern parts of the European Union or on the eastern or southern flanks of NATO, but throughout our transatlantic alliance, including the United States. Thank you.
Thank you. Time for a few more questions. Could we take the lady at the back in the center? I'm sorry, I'm choosing the people that make you run the most.
Hi. I have a question for you. Could you say
who you are, please?
Oh, sorry. My name is Dora. I have a question regarding Brexit. Do you think that EU has failed as an international institution, maybe, because they might have let the British people down in regards to the result of the referendum in June? Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. And could we take the gentleman here, please? I'm sorry.
Thank you. Fatmir Basimi, visiting senior fellow at Research Southeast Europe, LSE. I was carefully listening to you, especially the part mentioning that you are in favor of EU enlargement for the Southeastern Europe. And I have a question here, two aspects of this question, which is, how do you think you can this promote in terms of being high in the agenda of the EU, apart from all the challenges that you mentioned that EU has? And the second, what is the same question, the message to the regional or local leadership or political elite to achieve this? So okay, the message you. To
in the country, in the aspiring countries.
Yes. Thank you.
Thanks. Then could we take the lady over here, please, on the second row?
Thank you very much. My name is Magdalena. I'm a student here at LSE. And well, first we talked about solidarity, and when, with regards to enlargement, what do you think will happen in the rest of the Balkans? When will that enlargement happen? Especially given the recent events of hate and, you know, disruption in the rest of the Balkans, especially I'm talking about Serbia in this respect and Bosnia. And secondly, so what concrete measures do you think that Croatia should take in order to make young people come back? Because personally, I mean, I'm now being educated one of the world's best institutions, and I would like to come back to Croatia. But personally, I do not see myself. I don't think that Croatia at this point could offer me, you know, the same things that England or another country in the EU could offer. So yeah, that was it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So has the EU failed as an international institution because it has allowed the citizens of the UK to choose their own future? No, exactly the opposite. It's the right of choice. The citizens here in the United Kingdom decided that they no longer want to be part of the European Union, and that will has to be respected. And that is the point of... experience from Croatia when we were part of a superstructure called the former Federal Socialist Republic of Yugoslavia. whose constitution from 1974 provided the right to self-determination to the nations, including the right of secession. But that right was denied to us in the early 90s, and we had to fight for our right to freedom and democracy, and after all, to fulfill the 1974 constitution, which gave us the right to do that. So in contrast to the former Yugoslavia, which was an undemocratic structure, the European Union respects the will of the people. And whether it has been persuasive enough in terms of its benefits, this is what I talked about. I think we need to talk more about what the EU brings to our people, but that's not just the responsibility of Brussels, that's the responsibility of our national governments as well. On the EU enlargement or consolidation, as I prefer to call it, because Europe is not enlarging onto some territory that's outside of it, it's actually consolidating in Southeast Europe or the Western Balkans. I don't like the term Western Balkans because it has precisely ghettoized these few countries, aspiring countries, in a structure that is perceived to be struggling together. I'm for an individual approach. Countries should make progress on the way to EU and or NATO membership based on the criteria that they fulfill. So how are we going to keep it on the EU agenda? Together with a number of other countries, including Slovenia, Hungary, and others, we argue in Brussels that this is not just a technical process, it's a political process as well. Of course, it has to respect the political will of the people, but we also need to promote it as a process that's been beneficial to the EU. I mentioned in my speech that the area from the Baltics to the Adriatic to the Black Seas is currently the fastest growing area that's contributing to the growth of the EU as well. So we need to explain to the citizens of EU 28 the benefits of further consolidation of the European Union. The Brdo-Brijuni process that is led by Slovenia and Croatia, by President Pahor and myself, we have annual meetings where we invite politicians from all over Europe, where we argue and when we look at progress, take stock of progress that has been made, but also try to encourage our neighbors to pursue that same path, especially the path of reform. And my message to the leaders will be, yes, it takes time. It is becoming increasingly more difficult and more complicated. When we began negotiations in 2005, we talked to the Commission, and we all thought that it would take about two and a half years for Croatia to negotiate, to complete negotiations. So in about 2007 and accession in 2009. Well, we acceded on the 1st of July of 2013. So obviously it took longer because the EU has learned its lessons. The benchmarks are there to make sure that countries are fulfilling the criteria. So the message is be patient in that sense, but continue with the reform. And remember that whatever you're doing, yes, you're doing ultimately for the sake of membership, but first and foremost, for a better life in a better Macedonia or in a better Croatia, in our case, or in any other country who wants to join. Because whatever you're investing in the accession process, you're investing in your own economy, in your own people, in fighting corruption, in building strong institutions and democratizing your societies, which in turn will reap other benefits, economic benefits, a better credit rating, and more trust in your economy with respect to foreign direct investment, etc. Now, on solidarity and enlargement and when it will happen, it's very difficult to say when. We're fighting for that to happen as soon as possible. Again, I stand for an individual approach. I don't think that any country should be hostage of another country that is perhaps making slower progress. This is why I resent taking the Western Balkans as a whole. I think that every country should proceed based on their own merit. Now, some disruptions when you mentioned Serbia and Bosnia and Herzegovina, I don't know whether you meant the referendum that took place recently on the National Day and the announcements that there will be further referenda that half of the country would decide on the future of the country. We're very much concerned about that. Croatia thinks that that referendum is completely against the Dayton Peace Accords, the Constitution of Bosnia and Herzegovina, and the international community has acknowledged that this was an illegal referendum. And I think that we all need to focus a lot more on Bosnia and Herzegovina and help that country to become fully politically emancipated, based not just on the equality of every single citizen, but what the Dayton Peace Accords provide for, and this is why Bosnia and Herzegovina is perhaps different from some other countries, the constitutional equality of the three peoples and others. So until we've invested in that country, not just in terms of economic and social changes, but political changes as well, political growth, growth of new political elites, we will not be able to move the country forward, and it will continue to deteriorate. With Serbia, Croatia was among the countries who pointed to several criteria, especially in the context of chapters 23 and 24, which is the rule of law, functioning of society, respect for human rights, for minority rights, cooperation with the International Criminal Tribunal, etc. This is all the criteria that we have had to fulfill and that are actually part of the stabilization and association process. So we will be helping our neighbors, Serbia included, with everything that they think that they can learn from us, but also insisting on the fulfillment of the criteria because, again, ultimately it's for the benefit of the society in Serbia. And especially one of the requests that we had is the fulfillment of the agreement on mutual protection of minorities, so for the minorities in Serbia as well. What concrete measures we can take in order for young people to come back to Croatia? I could talk about that forever. I think that the basic one right now, as I said, is to change that climate in society, that it's not hopeless, that it's there is too much pessimism in Croatia right now, and I think it's changing, and I see after this last election that perhaps the mood has picked up. But we need to be more positive, so we need to provide not only economic opportunities, not only jobs, not only housing for young people, but really mobility, lifelong learning. And what also is one of the problems why young people like you are leaving is that we say we educate people, we want to have an educated society. The percentage of people who attend tertiary education in Croatia is high in Europe, but our labor market requires mostly just qualified or unqualified workforce. And this is the problem, the huge discrepancy between our economy and the needs, the requirements of the economy, and our education system, which is basically producing human resources and the value, the human capital, that unfortunately has become an export product in Croatia. And this is what we need to face as a society. And we need to begin with primary education. We need to introduce the system of dual education, of mentoring at work, and reform the structure of our society to give a boost to SMEs especially, who will create more jobs, and to invest a lot more and value technology and innovation a lot more than we do right now. So these measures, for starters, I would really start a debate in Croatia that focuses precisely on these crucial issues, from demographic trends to the economy to the social system, in order an education, a reform, in order to include the whole of society, and hopefully you as well and many others who are here from Croatia, to give your own input, your own ideas, to tell us what bothers you, why you left, and what you would like to see change in Croatia. And I think this could be one of the biggest benefits of people who study abroad and ultimately decide to come back home to Croatia.
Thank you. I'm tempted to ask one last very quick question. You are one of the few female presidents on the planet. You know the United States very, very well. Are you hoping for a female president in the White House, and could you work with the alternative?
Well, I have to be very diplomatic and say that, of course, it's for the American people, which is the truth. It's for the American people to choose their president. And then for the rest of us to work with whatever choice they have made. But I hope that election campaigns or pre-election campaigns, as we've seen in so many countries, are that ultimately the rhetoric that we've heard and the heightened emotions calm down, and that we realize that we so much depend on each other. And as I said, I believe in the transatlantic solidarity. And Croatia perhaps is not a big country geographically or when it comes to the number of people, but we would stand shoulder to shoulder with the United States if they needed us. And so we expect the same for the United States for the whole of the NATO alliance.
Okay, thank you. It's a tradition, President, that when we have distinguished guests, the London School of Economics would like to give a small gift to show our appreciation. Can I pass you this small shield so that you will remember LSE? Can I make just one request? Could you please remain in your seats whilst the President leaves? She's got a very busy schedule. So if you please stay in your seats. But the other request is, can you join me in giving a very warm round of applause to the President?